You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adam's way.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for Atomic Show number 167, I think.
I really should do more preparing. It's really number 168.
It's June 8th, 2011, and with me I have Tom Popick, who is a engineer who is a, let's see, he's a member of the, or are you a member or the leader of the Foundation for Resilient Societies?
I could be best described as the founder, actually, of the Foundation for Resilient Societies.
Okay, good. And so, Tom, what's the major thing that Resilient Societies does? What is your major reason for being?
Well, we have a very technologically dependent society in the United States, as well as a lot of other Western countries. And because the society is so complex and so technologically dependent, in a lot of ways, it's vulnerable to natural disasters. I could list off several, but the one that I think is the best example is what's called a geomagnetic disturbance or a solar flare. The way this would be a danger is if a burst of particles, charged particles from the sun, and the sun sends out these particles when there are solar flares. This burst of charged particles hits the Earth's magnetic field, and it induces currents in high-voltage transmission lines. These high-voltage transmission lines essentially act like big antennas. The induced current goes into high-voltage transformers, and it can burn out these transformers. It turns out that there's no domestic manufacturers of extra high-voltage transformers, and so if enough of these transformers get burned out, large parts of the country could be without electric power for several years, actually, until we could get replacements from the manufacturers overseas. So this is an example of a rather severe threat to American society, which can also be protected against at very moderate cost. There are several estimates about how much it would cost to protect against that, but it's in the hundreds of millions or, you know, a few billion dollars, which if you divide it among all the ratepayers is a pretty small amount. So this is an example of a societal threat that we would seek to protect against, and this is one of our projects.
Okay, let me ask you a question. If this is a risk, why hasn't it happened already? We've had an electric power grid supplying our industrial society for probably close to 100 years now.
That is a really excellent question. We have had these large geomagnetic disturbances or solar flares before. So one example is in 1859, there was a large solar storm. It's the so-called Carrington event. There weren't any long conductors, man-made conductors at that time, except for telegraph wires. So the current induced in the telegraph wires was actually sufficient to burn out the equipment at the ends of the wires. And then there was another large geomagnetic disturbance in 1921, but in 1921 the electrical grid wasn't really fully built out. So we haven't had a built-out electric grid since the end of World War II. Essentially, our modern electric grid is a post-World War II creation. It's fortunate that we haven't had one of these really large solar storms and geomagnetic disturbances since the grid has been built out in its current form. We've had some smaller ones. There was one in 1989 that hit the province of Quebec in Canada and actually caused a blackout and damaged some equipment. Also, the Salem Nuclear Power Plant in New Jersey had one of their large GSU transformers, generator step-up transformers, burned out by a solar storm. So these things do happen, but they haven't happened in the magnitude of the 1859 or 1921 events since the electric grid has been built out.
Okay, well, forgive me if I'm being skeptical, but the equipment that's on the power grid is substantially more resilient to large currents than a telegraph equipment would be. Telegraph equipment was designed to be very low current carrying, and you know it's only designed to carry dots and dits rather than carrying massive amounts of electricity.
Well, Rod, I actually think you've pinpointed, perhaps inadvertently, the issue. The large electric transmission lines do carry quite a bit of current, and you're correct that the transformers on either end of the line are designed to handle high amounts of current. The cores for the transformers are actually made out of steel, and they have a limited linear range for those cores. It's like a rubber band. When the rubber band isn't stretched very much, it's at one end of the linear range, and when it's about ready to snap, it is at the other end of the linear range. So these large transformers tend to operate just within the linear range, and if they get a DC current, which biases the cores, then they are no longer in the linear range, and the flux tends to overflow out of the core and into other parts of the transformer. When the flux overflows, it causes a lot of heat, and so once the transformer heats up, they aren't designed to handle that amount of heat, and the insulation between the windings starts melting, or in some cases, the core starts to melt. And so that's why this modern equipment, although it is designed to handle a lot more current, you're absolutely correct, you know, that same characteristic makes it more vulnerable to these kind of disturbances.
Now, how does a disturbance from a solar flare compare to a massive lightning storm?
Well, it's a different kind of disturbance. The rise time, I think that most of the people who listen to your show would be engineers or technical people. Would that be correct?
Oh, that's pretty correct, yep.
Okay, good.
We geek out here, so there's not too many non-techies who can patiently
listen
to the show.
That is really wonderful, by the way. This is my second show today, and I did one earlier, which was a lot less technical, so it is a real pleasure just to be able to pick up on some of the technical details from the beginning. But the difference between lightning and these geomagnetically induced currents, GIC as they're called, is the rise time. So the rise time on lightning and also the fall time would be a lot shorter. So there would actually be less energy. I think that if we were to take an integral, for example, of the of the waveform, there probably would be less energy in the lightning strike that would hit the transformers than with these induced currents.
I just came from a visit to the west coast of Florida, the panhandle of Florida, and went through a lightning storm that was one of the more impressive lightning storms I've ever been in, where there were bolts that were lasting a good 4, 5, 6 seconds from the time that they started till the time they dissipated, and even saw one hit the ground maybe 50 or 60 feet in front of our car. Burst out a little bit of flame and stuff like that. And, you know, having grown up in one of the lightning capitals of the world, and my father was a transmission substation engineer, so I remain skeptical that sunspots are going, or sunstorms, solar flares are going to cause significant disturbances on the power grid, but I'll let you keep going.
Okay, sure. Well, if I could add a couple more things, because I think that we're really hitting some key points in the conversation. The induced currents from these solar disturbances can actually last for hours or even days. So we could get a mass of charged particles that would come from the sun that would actually impinge on the Earth's orbit over quite a period of time. And so we could get sustained heating of the transformers. And it's really that sustained heat that causes the damage in the transformer.
Okay.
But you bring up an excellent point, which is the currently configured electric grid really does an excellent job against or protecting against lightning strikes. You know, that is a common occurrence. And I will confess, I'm not a transformer engineer, so I don't know all the details of how the grid currently protects against lightning strikes. But I do know there have been multiple examples, even in the last 20 years, of these extra high-voltage transformers being burned out by relatively small geomagnetic disturbances or solar flares. And so I think that it is within the realm of possibility, even probability, that a large storm could do quite a bit of damage.
Okay. So one of the reasons that I invited you on to the Atomic Show is your suggestion that one of the more vulnerable parts of our society or industrial infrastructure might have to do with nuclear energy?
That's correct. So we all know, if we're engineers and we're even just a little familiar with nuclear power plants, that nuclear power plants can't generate their own power except if they're connected to a fully functioning electric grid. So some people have the misconception that you can disconnect a nuclear power plant from the grid and it continues to make its own power to for all the pumps and circulation and cooling systems. And so the people who listen to your show know that that is not correct.
Well, they know that that's not correct for the currently designed and operating commercial nuclear power plants.
That's correct.
Everybody on my show understands there's at least 100 reactors operating off the grid all the time that produce their own power.
Well, I could think of, for example, nuclear submarines.
That's what I'm talking about.
Would be an example of that. And, you know, in the future, we could have what are called walk-away-safe reactors.
And we also have reactors that are being designed with islanding capabilities from the ground up. Not that I have any direct personal knowledge of such a capability, but I've heard that it's possible.
Well, you bring up really excellent points. Richard Lester, who is the head of the MIT Nuclear Engineering Department, had a very excellent editorial in the Wall Street Journal, I'd say about 6 weeks ago or so. And he brought up the point that today's nuclear reactors are really early generation devices. And 100 years from now, we really could work out a lot of these issues with reactors, and they could be safe in many ways. So they could be walk-away safe, for example, and they could also be safe if they weren't continually connected to a functioning electric grid. So you bring up some great points there.
Mm-hmm. And I will challenge your assertion it'll take 100 years. I believe that the technology exists today for those. As a matter of fact, I know of at least two reactor designs that have been tested at much larger than laboratory scale, which demonstrated the ability to passively shut down and move into a stable condition without any coolant flow or power applied to them. That was the German AVR in the early 1980s, and then the EBR-2, which is also known as the Integral Fast Reactor, performed the same test in 1986, just a couple of weeks before Chernobyl blew up. So nobody's really heard much about it and somehow got lost in the news. But as a matter of fact, I have a video on my hard drive of a reactor called the HTR-10, which is operating in China today at the Tsinghua University. And there's a whole bunch of international scientists watching the reactor operators turn off all flow and get very bored as the reactor puts itself into a stable condition.
Certainly. And that 100-year figure, by the way, I'm going from memory, but I believe that was the number of years that Professor Lester had mentioned in his editorial.
Right. And nobody's ever accused MIT of being in favor of nuclear energy, at least nobody who understands what their real motives are. But that's just me.
Well, they have a pretty big nuclear engineering department. But,
I understand.
Yeah.
But they also have people who are adamantly opposed to lots of nuclear technologies like recycling fuel and those kinds of things. So, anyway, okay. So the editorial said that reactors might be vulnerable to large losses of power. So what does the Foundation for Resilient Societies want to do about that?
Well, I think we need to distinguish between the cooling systems for the reactor core and the cooling systems for spent fuel pools. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we see in Fukushima is that, yes, there was very significant damage to the reactor cores, but for the most part, a lot of that radiation was actually contained. In other words, it stayed in the physical containment. I'm not saying that the amounts of radiation released were trivial, but I'm saying that I think the vast majority of radioactive material was, in fact, contained. Spent fuel pools have a different circumstance. They really don't have any fundamental physical containment. They're in industrial-style buildings with metal sides that aren't airtight, and so if we were to get a circumstance where the spent fuel pools were to start emitting substantial amounts of radiation, there really wouldn't be any containment. And there's another circumstance with spent fuel pools. In the United States, the pools have been pretty much filled up for many years because the United States government hasn't got their act together and come up with a location for a permanent repository. So there's a lot of spent fuel pool in the pools. You know, typically, it would be maybe at least four full reactor cores. So if there is a spent fuel pool event, the results could be pretty dramatic.
Well, let me ask you about the theory to practice. And one of the things that we always did in the submarine force was take advantage of when real events happened and gather as much data as we could to see if it backed up our assumptions and models. And based on what I've been reading from highly technical sources, the news reports of the issues and the spent fuel pool at Unit Number 4 have been grossly exaggerated. From what I can tell, the pool did experience a significant loss of water, which caused radiation levels to go up and caused some people to get a little bit nervous. However, videos taken inside the pool in the last week or so have shown that the fuel in the pool was not damaged.
I'm really glad you brought that up. We have the advantage that a report was released on the Japan nuclear events just a couple of days ago, a 750-page report, mm-hmm. And it includes a reasonably complete section about the Fukushima Daiichi spent fuel pool number 4. I will say that if you read the report, what it says is that the current hypothesis, and I think that this could be even characterized as the best hypothesis, is that the explosion which occurred at spent fuel pool number 4 was not caused by hydrogen produced by uncovery of the spent fuel rods in that pool, but was instead produced by hydrogen in one of the adjacent reactor cores, and that hydrogen went through a venting system that had a common exhaust and backed up into the area of the spent fuel pool, and then there was some sort of ignition source, and that caused the explosion, which really blew the roof and the sides off of spent fuel pool number 4.
Right.
So at this point, based on the report, I think that that may in fact be the best hypothesis. Another fascinating aspect to that report, they have a table. It's table 654, and it's an analysis of the radioactive material in spent fuel pool number 4. And so what it shows is that the iodine-131 is actually, the levels of iodine-131 are diminishing, as you would expect, because that has a relatively short half-life. And the levels of the cesium-137 are much more constant. So based on the analysis of the radioactive material taken from water samples, they've concluded that there has not been significant damage to the fuel rods. in spent fuel pool number four. Mm-hmm. So I think that this may be a really good example of predicting that any spent fuel pool that is deprived of power for the cooling system for a relatively short period of time, that there's no certainty that the water is going to boil off and that we're going to get a spent fuel pool fire.
Right.
So I think that you bring up a really excellent point.
Well, and that spent fuel pool was deprived of power for approximately 6 or 7 days, if not more, before it finally was got water restored to it. So I'm not sure exactly what the timeline is, but I know it was at least 5 days after the earthquake when the chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, who has no nuclear training at all, proclaimed that the fuel pool was on fire and recommended evacuation for all Americans within 50 miles, which was a tremendously ill-conceived recommendation.
Rod, I think he actually even said more than that. I think he said that the pool, according to their best estimate, was dry.
Right. And on fire.
I don't remember the on-fire part, but I do remember the dry part. I actually watched the congressional testimony.
Mm-hmm.
At the time I heard that, I was skeptical because if you actually do the calculations for that spent fuel pool,
mm-hmm.
and it was an unusual circumstance because the spent fuel pool, instead of having one-third of the reactor core having been recently removed from the reactor, it actually had a full core in it. So it had about three times the normal heat load.
Mm-hmm.
But even with three times the normal heat load, that 6 day period or so, it was actually, I think, from Thursday until Monday morning, was too short of a period for the water to heat up to the boiling point and then to boil off down to the tops of the fuel rods.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just basic physics, right?
Right, you can calculate how, and of course there's always evaporation over the top of any warm body of water. Anybody who owns a hot tub can know that there's clouds of steam leaving that hot tub even without it being close to the boiling point. But you can calculate how much water is boiling off because the latent heat of vaporization is a known physical constant, and you know how much heat it takes and how much water there is, and yeah, it's not a hard calculation.
You're correct. It's not a hard calculation. And moreover, the folks from TEPCO actually publicized the heat load for that pool. And I independently calculated what the heat load would be, knowing that the design of that reactor, at least to my understanding is correct, was very similar to the Oyster Creek reactor in the United States.
Yep.
And you could take there's some standard formulas for what the heat load would be for a certain period of time after shutdown, and we knew what that period of time was, and so we were able to calculate the heat load, and it would really be impossible, absent of any leaks in the pool, for that amount of water to have boiled off down to the level of the fuel rods.
Mm-hmm.
An interesting wrinkle, though, is once TEPCO started putting more water into the top of the pool with those concrete trucks, the amount of water that they were adding each day, which is about 70 metric tons, would be greater than the amount that would be lost due to evaporation or vaporization. And so what we suspected was that there was a leak someplace in the pool. Now, if you read the report carefully that just came out a couple days ago, TEPCO is saying that they examined the pool and they haven't found any leaks. I think if we were to summarize all the information about spent fuel pool number four, one of the things that we could conclude is there is a lot of conflicting technical information. Not all the pieces of the puzzle fit together here.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that although perhaps the best hypothesis right now is that the hydrogen that caused the explosion came from the adjacent reactor core and through the venting system, I wouldn't be willing to say the case is closed on it. I think that certainly a detailed examination of the fuel rods in that pool would be in order. At this point, I think that what we have essentially is a video of the top of the pool, but there may have been some uncovery of those fuel rods that occurred and may have been some hydrogen that was produced as a result of that. So we really don't know at this point. But in any case,
the one thing that we can hypothesize is that there was a significant loss of shielding, at least from the pool. You know, that pools are designed to have a lot of water above the rods, not just for cooling, but to protect the workers. 27 feet of water is a very good shield, because you drop a tenth thickness about every 2 feet. So that means that the radiation levels go down by a factor of 10 with every 2 feet of water. So if they lost a significant amount of water, even if it, you know, just evaporated down and you were down, instead of at, you know, a 27-foot shield, you only had a 6-foot shield, the radiation levels that were measured were indicative of having lost a lot of shielding, especially when the helicopters flew over the top, which was, again, a very poor response, because a helicopter can only carry X number of pounds of mass when it lifts off. And I ran a calculation that figured out if the helicopter was managing to dump its water directly into the pool and not lose any, which is a really bad assumption, it would take 63 trips to raise the level of the pool 1 meter. They just can't carry very much water.
Rod, I completely agree with you, and I don't think that they really brought those pools under control until they got the concrete pumping trucks in there. Mm-hmm. They were spraying them down with some fire engines, and even with the fire hoses, I'm not sure how much water got into the pool.
Well, I would be willing to say that they didn't get the radiation levels under control. There was really, as far as I can tell, although a lot of fear, there wasn't much going on in the pool other than rods doing what rods do, which is give off radiation.
Right. So you bring up an excellent point, which is there's really two fundamental reasons that the water has to stay in the pool. One is the water is a very necessary radiation shield, and to the extent that there's workers on site that are trying to bring the reactor cores under control, they need that radiation shielding because the pools are adjacent to the cores. Then the other reason, this is what you hear the anti-nukes talk about much more often, is the possibility of a so-called spent fuel pool fire. And so the theory here is that the water evaporates below the level of the tops of the fuel rods, and then the fuel rods, from the decay heat, build up to a temperature of about 900 degrees centigrade. And then zirconium reacts with the water. The zirc turns into zirconium dioxide, and the water produces hydrogen. And then that hydrogen, of course, can, you know, immediately oxidize, or it could build up and cause an explosion. So there's been a lot of debate over what the probability of one of these zirconium fires would be. I think it's clear to say that if the rods have been very recently removed from the reactor core, there's a much greater chance of a zirconium fire.
Right.
If they've been out of the core for an extended period, several years, then that chance is probably very small. So one of the things in the petition that we submitted to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is we didn't say that there's an absolute certainty of zirconium fires if the fuel rods become uncovered by water. We only say that there's a probability of that happening. And I think that that's really an important distinguishing characteristic between our petition for rulemaking and perhaps some other petitions that have been submitted to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. We're not trying to overstate problems. What we're trying to do is come up with a reasonable technical statement of what the problem is, and then, you know, following that through to its logical conclusion.
Well, let me ask you, here's a question, and maybe you can help me understand. It almost seems like illogical reasoning to say that, A, if the water goes away, the rods heat up, and that, B, if the rods heat up to a certain temperature, the coating of the rods will react with water to produce hydrogen. Now, if the rods are heating up because the water disappeared, how do the rods react with water to produce hydrogen?
That's another excellent question. See, we know any part of the rods that are completely covered by water are not going to be greater than 100 degrees centigrade, right?
At the surface of the rod, correct.
At the surface of the rod. That's basic physics, right? That's the way it is, okay? We know that when the rod is no longer in the water, then it would heat up and reach some kind of steady state, depending on what the temperature of the air was and how efficient, you know, the convection would be between the air and the rods and that kind of thing.
Right. Well, and it wouldn't really be air, right? If there's if the rods are 15 feet tall and the top of the rod becomes uncovered, there's still a certain amount of rod that's covered by water.
That's correct.
And above the water, there's probably a cloud of steam that has a pretty reasonable heat transfer coefficient to keep some heat leaving the surface of those fuel rods at that point. Now, I've never modeled it, but it just seems logical to me that the rods aren't completely dry yet and that there is some limitations on how fast they can heat up because they're not heating up in an insulator. They're heating up with a flow of a heat transfer fluid going across them.
Right. I think that the thermodynamic theory there would be, and actually this would involve chemistry as well, that as that steam passes by the superheated rods, that there would actually be an exothermic reaction. And that would cause a fire, but I'm going to say fire in quotes, okay? Because it wouldn't be a fire, I don't believe, in the sense that, you know, we have a campfire or something like that, which is, you know, something oxidizing. Mm-hmm. There's certainly an exothermic chemical reaction going on, but I don't know that it would, you know, necessarily be a fire. It could be that the zirconium would directly react with oxygen, you know, surrounding. But I think that, you know, quite a bit of modeling and maybe even experimentation would have to take place to really definitively determine that.
Yeah, there's a professor out at University of California, Berkeley, who was called by a local television station when this fuel pool issue was going on. His name is Yermans. And Charles actually did an experiment where he pulled a zirconium tube and hit it with a blowtorch to try to get it hot enough so that it would, in fact, have this exothermic reaction. And with a rod, he was not able to do that. Now, he later did a similar experiment with shavings of zirconium and was able to get them to get to a self-sustaining exothermic reaction, but that was at a considerably higher temperature. Like 2,000 degrees C.
Correct. I think that professor's experiment was fundamentally correct. And I've read studies of similar experiments. There have been studies of zirconium because it's used in various industrial processes. And when it's machined, mm-hmm. of course, it can turn into shavings or powder. And,
right.
and in shavings or powder, it can actually ignite in a self-sustaining oxidizing reaction. But when it's in a solid block or perhaps even a tube, it's very difficult, maybe even impossible, to get zirconium to ignite. One of the reasons is it develops a surface oxidation layer.
Right.
So, you know, so it's a black layer, and you know, that prevents, you know, further oxidation. It's a little bit like a lot of materials, like copper pipe, for example, does that kind of thing, too.
That's why zirconium is used as the cladding for fuel rods in a light water reactor where during operation the surface temperature of the fuel rods is somewhere in the neighborhood of 600 to 800 degrees Fahrenheit, and the zirconium is used to protect the fuel material against corrosion, and part of the way it does that is it has a very adherent oxide layer that keeps it from rusting any further.
Exactly. But I think to really replicate the conditions in a spent fuel pool that would be experiencing fuel rod uncovery, it wouldn't. We couldn't just heat up a rod in an oxygen environment, we'd have to heat up the rod in a steam environment,
right,
and see if the rod would react with steam. I know that Sandia Labs has done some modeling. I'm not sure if they've done experimentation about this. And it's significant, I think, that the results of the Sandia Labs modeling were classified. And I think that if there was absolutely no chance that the zirconium-cladded fuel rods would ever ignite under any circumstance, then that report probably wouldn't have been classified. So I think the fact that it is classified gives us a clue. It, you know, it may be that there's only a danger for a short period after the rods are removed from the reactor core, but, you know, not for a period of, you know, years or maybe even months. I think it's fair to say it's an open question, but I'm going to go back to what you said at the beginning of this portion of our discussion. There's really two reasons that these spent fuel rods need to be covered. One is the radiation shielding, and the other one is the chance of self-sustaining reaction. I won't call it a fire, but a self-sustaining reaction that would release radiation. Mm-hmm. And if the plant operators would want to have continued safe access to the site, it would be advantageous at a minimum to keep those pools full of water. And that's one of the things that our petition really aims at. You know, we have a very modest proposal just add water to the top of the spent fuel pools for an extended period of time to make up for what would boil off. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so we're not asking for something, you know, big and complicated. We're asking for something very simple.
Now, how much would this simple thing cost to install and maintain?
Well, if you read our petition for rulemaking, of course, you know, the goal of these petitions for rulemaking, if they're well structured, is to have a modification to the CFR for nuclear plant operators. We tried to structure the wording so that it would allow the plant licensees some degree of flexibility, in fact, a large degree of flexibility in how they would actually meet the requirement. Having said that, I don't think the NRC is going to approve any petition for rulemaking that's technically infeasible. So what we did was, we actually investigated multiple unattended backup power sources. Now, why would a backup power source, this would be electric power source, be required? Well, essentially what we're proposing is that we would have a source of electric power, and that would run a motorized pump, a motorized water pump, and that motorized water pump would then put make up water into the pool. And the control system for this could be very, very simple. It would essentially be like a float switch that would turn the pump on and off. So we now have to say, well, what power sources are feasible? Diesel generators, the problem with diesel generators is that they are great sources when they can be well maintained and when there's people to fix them if there's a problem, but they don't work too well in a long-term unattended state. So although I personally called up diesel generator vendors that were used for unattended applications, for example, oil and gas platforms, that kind of thing, I don't think that was a viable long-term unattended power source. We also investigated solar panels, and I think that's a lot more feasible. You have to have quite a bit of solar panel area in order to get a small amount of power if you make allowances for the fact that you're going to have some cloudy days and you're going to have nighttime and that kind of thing. You're not going to get continuous power out of solar panels at all. And then we found two other power sources. One would essentially be a large thermocouple. In other words, you'd heat up this very large array of thermocouples and you get electricity out of it. And these are used as power sources for remote applications, mostly in oil and gas and the telecommunications industry. And then there's another source called an organic Rankine engine that essentially takes heat. It could even take waste heat from the spent fuel pool, although we're not proposing that because it would make the implementation more complicated. But you could get heat from a natural gas or a propane burner, and it would run this organic Rankine engine.
Where would the natural gas come from?
Well, you would have to have stored I shouldn't have said natural gas. I really should have said propane. You would have to have some large propane tanks on site. So I think that a very legitimate question would be, well, you know, hey, Tom, you'd have to store an awful lot of an awful lot of propane on site to have a two-year supply. So that, maybe that's not very practical. Well, it turns out that the decay heat from spent fuel rods really drops off pretty quickly. So in the first couple of weeks after the rods have been removed from the reactor core, you might have to add quite a bit of makeup water. And for those couple of weeks, you could use a power source that was powered by what I call fossil fuels, you know, in other words, like propane. But then after that initial period, the power requirements would be much more moderate, or as you get towards the end of the 2 years, they would in fact be almost minimal. And so you could have a relatively small solar array that would charge up a battery, and then when the water level got low due to evaporation or boil off, just top it off. So we took the time and trouble to call up various vendors and also investigate what the mean time between failures were for some of these backup power sources. And I think we pretty well assured ourselves that it's technically feasible to have a backup power source and a relatively small electrically powered pump that would just add makeup water. We're not asking for something really ambitious, you know, a big circulation pump and that kind of thing. We're asking for a very moderate cost and simple solution.
Well, okay. Now, I know a little bit about propane tanks. They're not exactly inherently safe. They have their own explosive nature. So by putting a large array of propane tanks on the site, what kind of increased risk are you incurring for the people who work at the site and other equipment that is stored on site?
As you point out, I'm quite sure that any time you add any fuel source to a nuclear power plant, you increase the risk. One of the tools that the nuclear industry uses is probabilistic risk assessment. And so when we wrote our petition, we actually have a PRA in the petition, and the PRA goes through the risk of spent fuel pool uncovery and fires and really justifies the petition based on that PRA. We also point out that it would be a good idea to have a PRA for any proposed solution. But we say explicitly in the petition that we didn't put a PRA in for a proposed solution because we don't know exactly what all the variants that the licensees might propose. Having said this, you bring up great points, and I think that a risk assessment for any kind of a solution that would produce makeup water would be absolutely appropriate, and that really should be a required part of the process.
Do you know how much a risk assessment for any change like that costs in terms of time and resources that have to be diverted from other activities?
I'm going to say that I don't know, although I will say that most of the risk assessments that the licensees are required to do involve the reactor core and a lot of equipment surrounding the core. I think that this would be a very much simpler risk assessment and potentially lower cost. But, Rod, you bring up another point. I think you're kind of backing into it, which is when any group proposes these kind of backfit requirements, it could cause, in fact, it would cause an increase in cost to the licensees. And is that increase in cost justified? We went through in our petition for rulemaking what the projected costs would be based on just the probability of fuel being uncovered and fires and also the explicit probability of a large solar flare or geomagnetic disturbance causing a sustained power outage. And we found that the costs were smaller than the benefits by a factor of about 100 or so. So I think we have quite a bit of running room in there to justify this. But having said that, I really think it is very important to run the numbers to justify these kind of proposals. I think this is one of the problems I have, perhaps, with some of the other petition for rulemakings that I've read, which is they make a lot of statements, but they don't always do a PRA or go into the details. And if you were to do that, sometimes things may not make as much sense as they would on the face of things.
Right. And the reality is that anybody these days with Excel and a few other tools can do a tremendous number of calculations and running the numbers with extreme accuracy, but the answer that one gets from any exercise like that is completely dependent upon the reality and accuracy of the initial assumptions made. And if the initial assumption is that a loss of cooling to a spent fuel pool is going to cause a massive amount of property damage or health effects, perhaps that's not a very good entering argument based on what we've seen from a spent fuel pool that lost a good deal of cooling.
Well, if we were to accept the hypothesis, the current hypothesis, that no fuel rod uncovery actually occurred because there's no significant damage to the fuel rods, I'm not sure that the Fukushima incident would be a good test case. To have a test case, we would actually have to have fuel uncovery.
Mm-hmm.
And according to the report that I read, what they're essentially saying is it doesn't look like fuel uncovery occurred. Having said that, though, I agree that we need to study these kind of questions, and when we don't know the answer, we need to put reasonable probabilities into the calculation. So, for example, we say if there were to be uncovery of fuel rods, in other words, the fuel rods were to be exposed to air or to steam, we would say that there would only be a 50% chance that there would actually be a fire. We're not, and that's a midpoint estimate. So we're not saying 100% by any means in developing both the PRA and the cost justification.
What if the answer is really that it's a 0.5% and you're off by a factor of 100?
Well, even at a factor of 100, just accounting for the projected loss of life, I think that it would still be cost justified. I want to say, though, in doing this kind of rigorous analysis, it was very illuminating because for one of the things that we did was we got data from the U.S. Census Bureau that would show the surrounding population around nuclear sites, and if both within a one-mile radius and a 10-mile radius. There's a very significant number of nuclear power plants that have no one living within a one-mile radius,
mm-hmm.
and have very minimal population within 10 miles. Of course, there are some exceptions to that, Indian Point north of New York City being an example. But it really is a very illuminating exercise to go through this on a rigorous basis and try and figure out what the potential fatalities would be as well as what the projected costs would be.
Now, when you did the projected fatalities, what model of radiation health effects did you use?
Well, we used the model from one of the NRC studies. So it would be New Reg 1738.
What year was that conducted?
I'd have to look that up. I don't know that offhand, and I don't want to take up time
right.
during the show.
I know there's a lot of NRC studies that were done during a period where the assumptions were politically motivated. Shall we say, to make nuclear energy look very bad, and they have been repudiated by the NRC in years since then. So some of the studies that were using numbers that were made to look make nuclear look bad done in the 1990s have been repudiated, and certainly there are many folks that do radiation health studies who have strong disagreements even with today's numbers for the health effects of low-level radiation or even moderate-level radiation.
I think you bring up something that should be investigated. If this conversation is intriguing to the members of the audience of your show, I would really encourage them to download the petition for rulemaking. It's a very detailed document. You can get it from our website, which is resilientsocieties.org, or it's also in the ADAMS system at the NRC. Mm-hmm. And you can actually go through and see what portion of new Reg 1738 we used. You can look at the assumptions. You can see whether we used the early evacuation or the late evacuation, and what the estimated fatality percentages would be. And then you can even read in the petition for rulemaking about where we believe that we were, I don't know if the right word would be conservative, maybe optimistic would be a better word, where we were optimistic in the use of the NRC assumptions. Mm-hmm. So I really would encourage people to look at that in detail.
So how would this proposal improve the resiliency of American industrial economy if it resulted in a high enough increased cost to cause the early shutdown of several older plants that are where the owners are marginally not interested in making significant investments to keep the plants running, say in Oyster Creek or whatever, and the output of those plants was replaced by some miraculously unsafe fuel like natural gas?
I think there's really two parts to your question. One part of the question is, if we were to just shut down all the nuclear power plants tomorrow, what would happen to our society?
No, I'm not. I didn't ask about shutting down all the plants. I'm asking about shutting down one or two. One more straw that's pushing down the camel's back and causing the early shutdown of another several plants. You know, we've had about 14 plants or so that have shut down early because of added burdens that came after the plant was licensed and operating safely by people who have written new rulemakings. And, you know, things like the Zion plants, Yankee Row, Connecticut Yankee, Rancho Seco, you know, there's, like I said, about 14 plants that have shut down before their end of life, and the output of those plants was not replaced by windmills or solar panels. It was replaced by burning more coal, oil, and natural gas.
This is a very legitimate question, and I'm going to try and answer it forthrightly. First of all, we don't have a hidden motive or a hidden agenda to force shutdown of nuclear plants. I know that there are some groups that perhaps what they do could be considered to have an agenda to it, but that isn't our agenda. We also took the time and trouble to try and come up with a cost estimate for this kind of safety improvement and then multiplied it by a pretty big factor in order to get the number in the petition. We had the petition reviewed by people in the nuclear industry before we submitted it to the NRC, and they gave us a dose of what I would call reality. And they said, look, any time that something's done with a nuclear power plant, it's not just the equipment cost. There's a lot of compliance cost that goes along with that, and a lot of testing and, you know, a lot of other, you know, backfit costs. And so, you know, just to look at what the equipment cost would be and then an installation and then, you know, multiply it by a factor of, say, you know, 8 or something like that, that may be being too optimistic.
Right, and then there's ongoing maintenance and testing for anything.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So I think that your question is very much a legitimate question, but I would also, again, ask people to read the petition and look at the costs that we came up with for some of these backup power sources. And I think that the cost of the safety improvement would have to be many, 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 maybe several orders of magnitude higher than the number we came up with to really materially affect whether a plant would be kept in operation or not.
Well, that's an opinion.
That's correct. I think we're getting a little bit into
Well, the question is, if commercial nuclear power plants in the United States have been operating for more than 50 years without yet harming a single member of the general public, any investment that you make or any additional cost that you add, it's hard to say that it's going to make them any safer than that. It may make them safer on a calculational basis or some sort of modeled scenario, but it's hard to beat a safety record of zero impact to the public over a 50-year period. That's a pretty hard safety record to beat.
Sure, Rod, but we have to recognize that one of the reasons for that safety record is that the nuclear industry has, in fact, made genuine safety improvements over that time frame. I'll give you one. There's been additional requirements for the backup diesel generators, and there have been a significant number of plants that have lost grid power and have had to and those emergency diesel generators were relied upon, and they started up. In some cases, it was necessary to have redundant emergency diesel generators because the first set didn't start up, but the second set did. And it, even with the diesel generators, some of those requirements have been placed since the plants were originally licensed. I'm not sure that we would have the safety record that you talk about if some of these safety improvements, which have in fact cost real dollars, hadn't been made. So there's this process of continual safety improvements that have gone on, and a safety improvement that has prevented a major radiation release, I think, is a cost-effective safety improvement.
Yep. All right. Well, of course, we can argue about whether something has to be operator-free because, you know, humans do tend to do work and are willing to refill fuel tanks and do a little diesel generator maintenance every now and again. It's the idea that you have to have the ability to walk away from a nuclear plant for 2 years is also something that is questionable as a requirement, and I certainly would resist the idea of adding that requirement. And the final question is, what has your organization done to make natural gas and coal safer?
Well, we haven't done anything to make natural gas and coal safer. I think that if a natural gas plant were to be shut off from the grid, we probably wouldn't see the dramatic effects that we see with a nuclear plant. And so I think that there is a legitimate reason for us to put a petition in for rulemaking with the NRC for this particular circumstance. Also, let's be clear, we do have a Nuclear Regulatory Commission here in the United States that does accept petitions for rulemaking from the public. I think that's a positive thing. I'm not sure that there's necessarily that safety parallel for other industries or that degree of opportunity that the public has to suggest these kind of safety improvements and have the benefits and the costs of the safety improvements openly discussed.
And that's a good way to end. Yes, the nuclear industry has the opportunity for the public, which includes competitors, to add cost to the nuclear industry, and we don't have that same ability to an industry that's proven safety record is far worse over many years. So that's an interesting dichotomy in our current regulatory environment. We somehow believe that nuclear has to be perfect and all others can blow up people and cause fires and dump their waste products into the environment with relative impunity and low cost, by the way.
Well, Rod, I'd go back to, again, we have a Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and we have an established process and the opportunity for people to make constructive suggestions. And sometimes those suggestions not only come from members of the public, they come from NEI too, and from the operators themselves. And so I think it's a wonderful thing that we do have the process.
Right, and sometimes they come from people like, I don't know, sell natural gas, who would prefer nuclear to shut down so they could sell more natural gas.
That may in fact be true, but I can assure you in this particular instance, we've gotten absolutely no support on the petition. No financial support from the natural gas or the coal or anything like that. I will say it's been interesting to me that for some reason publications that perhaps cater to other industries seem a little bit more anxious to talk about the petition. And I think that's been a little bit of a wake-up for me, you know, in understanding some of the, you know, I'll call economic politics of the issue. But whatever people's agendas are, you know, we're not trying to do anything here except propose what we believe to be a genuinely useful safety improvement to the nuclear plants.
You know, it sounds that your organization has put a lot of time and effort into this, and drafting a rulemaking is certainly not something that somebody does in their pajamas in their spare bedroom. Where does your funding come from?
I'll be very upfront. This is a really small citizen organization, okay? It's not just myself, but it is extremely small and completely self-funded. We haven't accepted any donations whatsoever. And you're right, writing this petition was a heck of a lot of work. But the people who wrote the petition and helped out on the petition feel very strongly that the country needs to be protected against these kind of potentially catastrophic natural disasters. If there's any what I'll call support, outside support for this particular petition, it comes from people who are concerned with geomagnetic disturbances and what's more generally called electromagnetic pulse. And so we have gotten help from people. As a matter of fact, earlier today I was on a radio show for Impact America, which is an advocacy organization that's concerned about electromagnetic pulse. And the people who are involved with that also, for the most part, don't get a lot of corporate funding, but they believe very sincerely in trying to protect the American society. So I think that your question, though, is an absolutely appropriate question, because it is important to know what the real agendas are and what the financial and economic motivations of people are when they propose these kind of things.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I've enjoyed talking with you, Tom. I can't honestly tell you I wish you luck on your petition, because I think that the process at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has resulted in an amazing depth of rules that make it extremely difficult to propose, design, and build new nuclear plants, and even to keep existing plants running without any increased safety to the public. So that's my personal opinion, and I am pretty well aware of how many rules there are and how thick the regulations are and how difficult it is to try to adhere to all of them. But
Rod, I would add to that, I think it's we don't need your support on the petition, but what you've demonstrated here is a lot of integrity by hearing us out on some of the reasons for the petition and the technical details. And we really appreciate that a lot. This is the kind of conversation we want to have. And we want this petition to rise or fall on the technical merits and the real justifications, as opposed to the political agenda. So I really do appreciate very much the opportunity to be on your show.
Good.
Thank you.
No problem. I do pride myself on integrity. People can challenge all they want, but, you know, there's one thing that started to be beaten to me when I was a very young person, and then and continued to be added as I served, through plebe summer and the Naval Academy, and as a commissioned officer in the Navy. Integrity matters, and it is important to listen to all sides and to honestly and forthrightly express technical reservations when somebody is making assumptions and assertions, and to listen to what they have to say. So I'm glad you could come on, and I hope that everyone enjoyed the show.
Thank you very much, Rod.
Bye.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today, raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today, now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.